This is a Dubai Eye 103.8 podcast. This is Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
It's all about living your best life.
On Dubai Eye 103.8.
Fantastic to have you with us for another episode of the Afternoons with Helen Farmer podcast. Have you ever had an office romance? What about an office affair? With the average person spending 90,000 hours in their workplace, it's no surprise that sometimes our attentions turn to our colleagues. We were discussing when it goes wrong and ultimately what are some of the HR policies in place. When and what should you tell your boss? That was with a relationship divorce coach and an HR professional too, plus a few of your real life stories too. And from romances to running, we were joined by Coach Yusuf. He is the head coach of the training program for the Abu Dhabi Marathon. And he was on hand to talk diet, technique and training ahead of the marathon in November. Lots of you getting in touch with questions from total beginners to those wanting to finesse their times. And as ever, it is Pets and Vets, your chance to get your animal questions answered. We were joined by Dr. Rachel, who had some fun facts about furry friends and was there answering and offering advice on everything from health to behaviour.
Home or away.
On Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
Be honest. Have you or would you date your co-worker? We're talking office place romances, leaving no stone unturned. And many are extramarital, and that can be pretty messy. Who hasn't heard the story of UK Health Secretary Matt Hancock? Married, had a secret affair with his closest aide as COVID gripped Britain. There's video evidence, and if you haven't seen it, I urge you not to see it. It cannot be unseen, especially with the Alan Partridge commentary. Absolutely horrendous. Early this year in May, Bill Gates acknowledged to a spokeswoman that he had an extramarital affair with a Microsoft employee last year. Gates and his wife, Melinda, decided to divorce after 27 years of marriage. In a divorce filing that day, she called the marriage irretrievably broken. Talk to us about workplace affairs and where they can go. Anne Jackson's with us, relationship coach, speaking to us on Microsoft Teams. She's seen many divorces here in the UAE, and there's no doubt some of them stem from affairs that may have started in the workplace. Anne, thank you for being with us today. How common is this?
Hi, and thank you for having me. Extremely common, especially here in, well, I don't know about the whole of the UAE, I deal with people in Dubai, but there's the whole community missing in Dubai because we're all from somewhere else. So people do get to think that they can get away with it, that there isn't a community watching them, that we're not going back into, you know, places where our uncles know us and our family know us. There's just, people think here is a bit of a toy town, so I think it happens a little bit more than maybe in other places.
Oh, interesting theory. There's no kind of path of truth. There's not Big Brother or, you know, your granny or your mate from school's, you know, next door neighbour watching. So it feels like, yeah, you're kind of under the radar a little bit. Plus, people work an awful lot of long hours here. You know, when we think about the amount of time you spend with colleagues, it can often end up being more than the time you spend with your spouse.
And there's so much pressure. I've said this before, I think, on the radio. There's so much pressure. If you're working here, say you're the breadwinner, you're the person earning. If you lose your job here, you lose pretty much everything normally because you're an expat. So you lose your house, the kids lose their school. There's a lot of pressure. So whenever you're in your home environment, that pressure is there. You see what you're working for. Whereas at work, if you kind of step out and have an affair, it's like having some release. It's like not having to think about the pressure. It's just having fun, you know, and not having pressure tied to it. So that happens a lot here because of that reason as well. And then, you know, the whole, you are working together, you're working on something together, you're working towards something together. There's a lot of adrenaline going on. There's a lot of energy going on when you're working together on things. So you put all that together and here is a perfect melting pot for extramarital affairs at work.
I think also for a lot of people, when you're at your job, you're in your workplace, you're doing something that you're good at. You're doing something that you're competent at. People are seeing your best self. You come home, you're tired, you might be struggling with juggling the kids, and you might not be feeling your best self. Often, I mean, think about, I'm certainly not implicating myself here, but think about me. I spend the afternoon talking on the radio. I come home and there is nothing in the tank for the husband at all. I'm like, yeah, sorry, I'm all talked out. Unfortunately, I know. I do make an effort sometimes, but I think a lot of people, it's, as you say, stressful job environments, putting all their energy into being their best selves at work for other people, and often taking for granted what they've got at home, perhaps.
Exactly. I mean, completely agree. And when I'm seeing couples together who, you know, might have got into trouble and want to make it and want to go forward, one of the little tricks or tips I always say is when you come in from work, either which one, whoever comes in first, take the first 10 minutes or 15 minutes to say five good things that happened that day, so that you start your day talking about with each other. It's the end of the day, but you're starting your day with each other, talking about positive things and relaying the positive things that have happened, so that it's a good note to start on, so that you're not taking each other for granted. Because that's another reason why office affairs happens, is that there is somebody who's actually admiring you because you're being your best self, mm-hmm. and they are giving you really good attention. And then you get home and you don't get that from your spouse, you're going to run off to the office affair, obviously.
I've started following the Gottman Institute on Instagram, and they are big advocates of giving your partner a 6-second kiss every single day. Apparently 6 seconds is the magic amount of time to get the happy hormones, the endorphins going. So I challenge all of you this afternoon, a little cheeky 6-second snog with your other half. But can I ask you, Anne, when it comes to extramarital affairs, and we're going to be talking about romances as well, but affairs in particular today, which is why a lot of couples will come to see you. Is there any coming back from it? Have you been able to successfully reconcile couples following infidelity?
For sure there is, but it really depends on why the affair happened in the first place. And it really is. So some people just end up, I know it sounds, we are all conscious of what we're doing to a certain extent, and we all have free will, but they get carried away with what's happening at work. They get carried away on a wave, and then they suddenly go, oh my God, what have I done? You know, I can't believe I was just about to throw away my family, my life for an extramarital affair. So people do kind of wake up from this dream reality they've been in. And yes, you can save marriages when it's in that case. But if, you know, if somebody actually isn't particularly sorry for having the affair, you can't really save the marriage then.
Now, if both members of that marriage are willing and ready to take the steps to reconcile, can you still do that if the person that was unfaithful is still working alongside the person they cheated
no.
with? No. Okay, good.
No. Well, people do try. People try. They sort of, but I've had people that, you know, they've tried for a year to stay in the same place, but it just, you have to build up trust when this happens. If you want to build your marriage back up again, you have to build up trust. And trust is you knowing that your partner has your best interest in the same place as their best interest. That's what trust is at the end of the day. Not that they put their best interest second, but they put you at the same place as them. Your best interest would be not to have your partner working with this person who's had an affair with, or she's had an affair with. So, you know, it's all about putting each other's best interest first.
The he-she thing is interesting, Anne. I know there's data around this, but obviously not specific to the UAE. But anecdotally, when couples come to see you, is there a trend in terms of, is it men or women who tend to be unfaithful?
So it's said that, you know, men and women are unfaithful for different reasons. So women tend to be unfaithful because they're being emotionally neglected. They're not being given time, as it were. Men, they more, you know, it's more for making themselves feel better, even if they are being given time and not neglected back home. So they do it for different reasons. But equally here, you have to remember in Dubai, there is a big percentage of married couples where the wife, if she has children, stays at home. So therefore, there are more men out there to have affairs with single women, as it were, than there are sort of married women to have affairs out there.
Home or away.
On Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
Now, many people meet their significant other at work. According to a Society for Human Resources Management survey published last year, more than half American workers' survey said they had a crush on a co-worker, while 27% had a workplace romance. It's not surprising, given the amount of time people spend at work with colleagues who share their experiences, their interests, possibly their values as well. To tell us more about when things can go wrong, ending in affairs ultimately and sometimes divorce, Anne Jackson's with us, relationship and divorce coach. And we've got caller Desma on the line to share her story. Desma, what happened to you when it came to a workplace romance?
Oh, hi, Helen.
Hi,
thanks
Desma.
For having me on air.
Pleasure.
So I have a very interesting story. So I met this guy at work. We dated for a good 2 years, and I even helped him find a new home in Dubai. set up his house and all of that great stuff. And then one morning, it was the morning of my first exam of my university. I was doing my master's at that time. I got a text message. It was from him. And it said, actually, I'm on a flight. I'm heading back to India and I'm getting married tomorrow.
No.
Surprise. Yes.
There'd been no preamble. There'd be no introduction of the fact that his family were... Oh, my goodness. And he was on the flight. So you couldn't even talk to him, presumably.
No, it was a text message. It was on the flight, yeah.
Oh, how did you react in that moment? Did you respond straight away? Did you throw your phone in the sea? Did you... I don't know. Was it worse than that? What did you do?
No. So, I mean, of course, it was pretty shocking for starters. But then I was very conscious that, look, I had an exam to focus on or I had him to focus on. And I just had to make a choice. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I just went into this robot mode and I said, okay, I'll come back to him, park my emotions, which was so hard to do, focus on my exam. And then, you know, I'll deal with the shock of it after. But then it didn't stop there because he messaged me the night of his wedding to say, hey, how was your exam?
What?
Yes.
On what planet?
I know.
So, Desma, how long had you been together when you got the shock text about him getting married?
At that point, it was about 2 years.
And had you talked about the future as a couple? Had that been discussed?
Yes and no, but not really seriously. So I know that his family wanted him to get married, but we had not reached that stage in our relationship.
I'm bringing in Anne Jackson, relationship and divorce counsellor. We were speaking earlier about that sense of escapism when it comes to workplace romances. And it sounds like Desma's ex had a whole other life and lie going on. Is that quite common?
Well, first of all, I'm really sorry to hear that. And well done you for parking your emotions and getting on with your exam and doing some self-care there. Yes, it is common, unfortunately, that... I've heard all sorts of stories, you know, people actually having wives and children in another country and pretending to be single here. And then the person that they're having a romance with finds out, or they're planning their marriage, like probably this guy was, with their family, you know, and it's just seen as a transaction, this marriage. So they're planning the marriage and they don't bother telling you because they don't think it's really anything to do with you, which is, you know, insane. But there are people who do that here, more than one. Yeah, there's plenty of people, again, because Dubai is full of expats without, you know, a huge community watching you, people do just make things up or avoid things or don't give clarity.
Desma, thank you so much for sharing your story. Are you happy now? Please say yes.
Oh, yeah, yeah. I got over it, of course. This was a few years ago, you know, and it didn't stop there because we continued to work in the same place. So I would continue to see him, obviously, at work. And then he continued to say, listen, I'm really sorry. I made a big mistake, to say the word and I'll leave my wife. And that's what makes this happen. So, you know, of course, I was like, what planet are you on? None of that happened. I moved on. And yeah, I'm super happy now. Still single, but super happy.
Desma, thank you so, so much. Oh, my
You're
goodness.
Welcome.
The absolute cheek of it. Double lives, married people on Tinder. If you've got a story to share, get in touch. And we want to hear the happy stories as well. Thank you, Dean, saying my now fiance and I were once colleagues and it was very tricky in the beginning, but we were honest with the leadership team once we knew it was something more serious than the fling. We've been together now 6 years. We need to remember the workplaces where we spend most of our lives. So these things do happen and they can end happily. And Jackson, thank you so much for your insights as ever. Really appreciate it. I know you're having a particularly busy time right now. So if anyone's in need of some relationship or divorce coaching, she's your woman.
Home or away.
On Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
Would you or have you dated your co-worker? Workplace relationships are incredibly common. Stats suggest around 65% of office workers have had a relationship with someone at work, while only 19% of employees admit to cheating with a colleague. 44% have said they've known co-workers who've had affairs at work or on business trips. So how would your company react to a workplace romance? And is it worth the risk? Rohini Gill joining us. She's an HR professional, senior management consultant and HR business partner at GGC Consultancy to tell us more. Rohini, have you ever had to deal with an office romance that has gone wrong in your office in your professional capacity? Oh, you're nodding. I can see you nodding. Go on.
Oh,
tell.
Yes.
Oh, no.
So many. Okay. So how many times have we dated someone and it's gone wrong?
Lots.
So many, right? Exactly.
Too
and now
many.
Compound that with the fact that you have to still continue seeing them.
Oh,
it's gonna go horribly wrong. And it does. And this is why, exactly why, Helen, we say, guys, be careful. Mm-hmm. Be careful. All of us want happy endings, but we know happy endings. Not every ending is a happy ending. You see what I'm saying.
Now, tell us then a little bit about the professional side. Do companies here in the UAE tend to have an HR policy on workplace relationships, Rohini?
Not an HR policy on workplace relationships as such, but it can fall under the conflict of interest. I'm going to give you an example. If somebody is working for HR, the HR department, and they're dating the finance director, when it comes to budgets or whatever, there can be conflict of interest. Yes.
Or
and that's
bonuses.
Where it falls under.
Mm-hmm. Okay, that's interesting. So if that, let's use that as an example. At what point would a relationship need to be declared? How transparent should a couple be with their company?
I've had people come up to me when we've been at clients right at the beginning. And I encourage that because we're here to look after employee well-being and the organization. So if somebody says to me, you know what, Rohini, I am seeing XYZ in the IT department. I work in finance. Is that kind of okay? I would say, give the IT budget to your colleagues so there's no conflict of interest.
Yes.
And just be careful. We're not ogres.
Lots of texts on this subject. Olga's saying, getting a job is easier than getting a significant other. So if it's true love, pursue it and find another job if it's in the way. Marcel says, hard pass, it's messy. And Rima simply stating, never. My co-workers aren't that dateable. I couldn't possibly comment on the Dubai Eye collection.
Excellent.
In your experience, are there any particular roles or industries where workplace relationships and even affairs are particularly common?
Oh, goodness. I think industries that work variable hours, shifts.
Hospitality.
Yes.
Yeah.
I didn't. But I can see why, Helen.
Of course.
Your partner would understand what you are experiencing, the different shift patterns. Mm. So I can't see it. Schools, I would say quite a few, because people come at the same time, they have the same holidays, they tend to socialize a lot together. So that definitely. But more to do with shifts, more to do with shifts.
So if someone's listening and they are embarking or thinking about embarking upon a relationship with someone that they work with. And I'm not talking extramarital, I'm talking about dating where both members are single and it's obviously consensual and you're both grown up, lovely people who happen to work in the same company. How do you suggest proceeding to make sure you're not risking your career?
If you've got a good relationship with your manager, which I really hope everyone does, she says, or the HR manager, speak to them. Speak to them, tell them. And the way to start this conversation is, I want to be completely transparent with you because I don't want any conflict of interest. I am seeing XYZ of department ABC. Speak to them.
We want to hear your stories too. Did you meet your partner at work? Did you meet your ex-partner at work? And Tamana took the plunge years ago.
I am one of the few who have taken the plunge and married my own boss. We've been married for 14 years. It started off typically as a hatred kind of a relation where we couldn't get along. We didn't like each other, ignoring each other's emails as well. It was just a common interest of the love for bikes that we both had. And one bike ride changed it all. And yeah, now we're married for 14 years. We have our two little bosses, both girls.
Two little bosses.
home or away.
On Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
We are talking office romance this afternoon. The average person will spend about 90,000 hours at work through their lifetime. And with that number in mind, it's no surprise. Workplace romances are bound to happen. So how to navigate them, protecting your career and, of course, pursuing love. We want to hear your stories. Did you meet your partner at work? How did it turn out? 4001, or you can use, of course, that ARN Play app. Message here saying, I have to say yes, the would you date a co-worker? I did, and 25 years and two dogs later, we're married. See, it can work out. I love this. And I think it's very natural, because you're ultimately working in an area that you're both interested in, you're showing your best selves. So, you know, it seems, why not? But as long as you're doing it properly, Rohini Gill's joining us this afternoon, HR professional, to explain why transparency early on is so, so key. So I also wanted to ask you, Rohini, you know, sometimes we heard earlier, you know, Bill Gates embarking upon an extramarital affair, and there's been questions raised about that, about abusive position and privilege, you know, senior member of staff. And what can I, how to phrase this, what can HR do to protect the member of staff who perhaps is getting unwanted advances or feels like they're in a compromised situation because of a senior member of staff who is giving them the glad eye, if not a bit more?
Every organisation should have, she says, a grievance policy. Speak to HR. Do not be scared of speaking to HR and confiding in them. HR will make sure you are looked after. Traditionally, do you know what, Helen? We always kind of assume that it's going to be the women who are getting unwanted attention. It can be both genders. Mm-hmm. And speak to HR. Tell us you're uncomfortable. We can make things happen confidentially. Nobody will ever compromise and put your career in jeopardy.
What about if it is the big boss, or you work in a small company and there is no HR department, which, you know, unfortunately, given COVID times, skeleton staff, or, you know, certain things being outsourced, that could be the case.
Speak to somebody you trust within the leadership team. So if you're talking an SME, for example, right? And it's the owner who's making a member of staff uncomfortable. Speak to a senior person who can speak to the owner. Mm-hmm. And kind of make, sometimes people don't even know what they're doing, sadly. And if they are doing it on purpose, then they need to know that it's wrong. And you know, you've caught on to it. If that makes sense.
It does make sense. We had a question along these lines when we were speaking to Ludmilla Malova earlier this week in our legal clinic. And it was regarding a senior member of staff who has since left the company, but text messages have recently come to light. And could that evidence be used? And her resounding answer was yes. You know, it's definitely not too late to make sure that someone is put to justice if they have been preying upon people, and it was multiple people who had come together. So thank you for that, Rohini. Much, much appreciated. And if anyone is in HR listening, any advice on that side in terms of how to navigate people coming to them with an office romance, with what they might think is really happy news, that they have found love and you're perhaps not so sure? How best to navigate if you are in HR? And this is coming through your door.
Oh, goodness. How best to navigate? Put yourself in the person's shoes. It's taken a lot of courage to come to you. Show your empathy. If you can't show empathy, at least show compassion. Mm-hmm. So this person's really excited. And we've had this. And you don't want to be the ogre. And you shouldn't be the ogre. Is show compassion, show understanding, but also make them aware of the dangers. Dangers, I say, but worst case scenario, that they're seeing this person, it doesn't work out, they still have to work with them. As long as they go in with open eyes, you've done your job.
I know. The thing is, when it goes right, it's great. And we've had lovely messages saying, you know, we met years ago at work. When it goes wrong, it can be crying in the loos, crying to HR.
Absolutely.
And wanting to quit your job. And yeah, that kind of, I don't want to say proceed with caution, because I know a lot of people that have met at work and it's been absolutely brilliant, but I don't know. Do you know what actually interested me looking into this earlier? You'd think that COVID, people working from home, would mean that workplace romances were on the downhill. Apparently not. Not the case at all. People finding a way and, you know, finding that connection, even when they're not physically in the office together. Have you heard of this too?
I have. And I'll tell you why that happened, Helen, because people weren't able to go out and socialize. Mm-hmm. We're social animals. All of us are. We need to be around people. And COVID and working from home taught us or kind of made us realign what we're really looking for in life. And so when they couldn't go out to restaurants or bars or whatever and meet people, the next thing was through work, whether it was through, their Zoom meetings or whatever, people opened up to each other a lot more mm-hmm. as well. So we've seen that. Yes, we have. I've forgotten what I was thinking. I wanted to go back to what you were saying about proceeding with caution, mm-hmm. which is exactly my advice would be proceed with caution, but don't just say no because you work together, but don't just get completely swept off your feet either. So there's a bit of common sense, which is what we would say to our friends if our friends came to us, and we would say the same thing. So treat HR as your friend and go to them and speak to them. And HR will hopefully give you the advice, same advice they would give a friend.
Rohini, thank you so much for joining us this afternoon. Much, much appreciated. I hope you haven't got any messy office romance fallouts crossing your door anytime soon. And to anyone out there who has embarked upon a relationship, wishing you all the very, very best. We do have regular relationship counsellors on the show, so feel free to reach out over the coming weeks.
Home or away.
On Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
Talking fitness or just trying to get fit, maybe you can barely run a bath. You've never run in your life. Maybe you run a lot and want to test your limit and try a marathon. Joining us this afternoon for a free running clinic as we talk diet, technique, training, gear and more is Yusuf Voshti, a multiple winner of USA Track and Field Championships in long distance running, the coach and event director of Ultimate Athletics at UAE and the head coach of the ADNOC Abu Dhabi Marathon Training Programme. Coach, how are you this afternoon?
Pretty well. How are you?
I am good. I'm expecting an influx of messages, to be honest, because I'm waking up early these days, and despite the warm temperatures, a lot of people, I think, are trying to offset their long working hours with a bit of a jog or a plod or a run around the block or further. So I'm really glad that you're here. Can you give us a bit of background? How did you get started in running and then eventually go on winning titles like in track and field championships in the States?
Well, as any old-fashioned boy, I started running in just as a game, actually. Back in the 90s, there's no like technology to just hold me over the home and play, you know, some kind of PlayStation or mm-hmm. something like that. So I had to plan for my games, so it was all running. So when I experienced running on the road just as a boy, I felt that I have that aerobic capacity that lets me go further and win everyone else when you have like, you know, sort of like straight competition. So I decided to be a runner.
Well, it sounds like you've got a natural ability for it. Do you feel like the world could be separated into runners and non-runners?
Well, I mean, I felt like, you know, I was genetically endowed and, you know, this is what I built to. So as, running actually is something, is a gift. Mm-hmm. So you can experience it in a very early age. So I would say so, yeah.
See, for me, running just does not come naturally. I have got no natural, I'm built for comfort, not for speed. Okay, this is what it comes down to. I find it really uncomfortable, and maybe it's technique for me that I just need some help with. And lots of people getting in touch about that very thing. You're training people for the Abu Dhabi Marathon. Before we get to the text line, Yusuf, can you just share details of the event? When's it going on?
The training, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, in Abu Dhabi, we have like, you know, sessions for over than 100 people every night session. And this is like goes every Sunday and Tuesday.
And when is the event itself taking place?
It's 26th of November.
So if someone's starting now, a complete beginner like me, who could make, I don't even want to say how far I could run, couldn't run very far. Is it too late to start training for a marathon now, as we're in the beginning of July? Could you reach that 40 kilometers by November, do you think?
No, it's never too late. You can start it from now. So, if you just have a structured plan and you want to go for it, I think it's the right time to start, and it's not too late.
Text coming in for you, Yusuf, on 4001. But before we get to those, I feel like running can feel like another world for a lot of people. It can feel quite intimidating. So can we start with the basics? How to get started? What kind of shoes? Do you need shoes? Do you need special shoes? Do you need expensive shoes? What is on your shopping list for someone looking to get started?
Regarding this topic, everyone like responded to specific thing for the shoes. So what it works for me, it doesn't have to work for you. So what I want to say is just like go and do some analysis with gait analysis over, like if you can go to a store and they have this analyze machines, so then you can feel how your pronation and how your arch like going comfortable with that shoes and go for it. There's no specific. And what we have in the market, there's like a different selection of shoes that can give a lot of options for the runners now.
Now, to the text line, and Ayush has a question.
I used to run track pre-COVID, but have since lost my form because of the lockdown. I used to run 5 kilometers and 10 kilometers. Now, if I want to take part in the marathon, what would be an ideal training regimen?
So we would be pretty comfortable running between 5 and 10 kilometers, but is a bit out of practice because of lockdown. What kind of training program would you recommend to someone who's, a moderate runner?
To run a marathon or to just like stick to his plan, which is 5 and 10.
And how often would you recommend to be exercising? How many rest days do you think are necessary if you are starting to get serious about marathon training?
The plan is all about how you structure your long runs, weekly long runs, and how you build up that. Long live runners, you should build up that thing, that long run, strictly. So going from 5K to 25K or 2.5 miles and to 60 miles, it should be planned over, especially over the heat that we are experiencing in the GCC countries or UAE in specific. So what I want to say, it's all about how you structure that long run from the start to the nearest date to the marathon. So going from that, you have to sustain a relatively steady and easy pace on the long run. Even though if you are starting from a short distance to the big distance, you should apply the same strategy as you go until you get close by the event, which is the marathon. This is why it's just one component we know. But also on the different, what we have in the training program for the marathon, it should be some sort of speed workout. That speed workout also should cut to short distance instead of long distance. Because again, what we experience in here with the heat and the summer, then this is going to take you to your goal, which is running a full marathon.
Home or away.
On Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
It is your running clinic between now and 4 o'clock. So whether you are a bit of a couch potato or maybe you are a medal holder, our guest today can no doubt offer up some advice. He is the head coach of the ADNOC Abu Dhabi Marathon Training Program. Yusuf Roshdi joining us on the line. You mentioned the heat of the summer earlier, Yusuf, when it comes to putting together a training schedule. When people are exercising inside on a treadmill, does their technique need to change to if they're out, say, on the beach track or on the pavement?
Well, definitely there's changes all the time. You don't experience the wind and the gravity outdoor than the treadmill. Treadmill is applying a specific technique that you can go on. And this is sustaining you for a long time during doing your exercise above the treadmill. But when you go outdoor, then you experience something else that you have to apply your technique. rather than something applied on you. Mm-hmm. So, you know, this, like anyone like training on the treadmill, he would experience like a differences from going on the treadmill and on the pavement or like any other road. So that's why giving like, you know, a suggestion here that why not you can mix both. Okay, so do the treadmill and go outdoor and try to hit the pavement for a run and try to apply your own technique. It's fine, like, you know, to train in the treadmill, but also you have to experience like what you can do in the pavement and apply it. And that is going to build your sustainable technique that you want to do it and apply it on the race day.
Because that's exactly it. You can train all you like in a treadmill, but it's not going to be similar conditions to what you're going to be doing in Abu Dhabi. But it is hot. It's really hot. Is there a time of the day that needs to be absolutely avoided? And what about hydration, Yusuf?
Yeah, I mean, we always have to choose, like, you know, a cooler temperature, which is like, you know, mostly in the early morning or like late afternoon, just to avoid like, you know, a sun strike or something like that, which can deplete us and get us dehydrated. And talking about dehydration, we have experienced a lot of like dehydration during the summer. So we have to have a good plan to hydrate ourselves. And in this condition, we cannot just rely on water. We have to get some kind of like, you know, iron drinks that is going to help us to for like fluid intake. And this is can be like, you know, a choose by the runner themselves, like what they feel like tuned to it, what kind of product they can introduce to the system. So to be hydrated, it's a practice and it's a technique. So don't wait for the real day and try to experiment like new stuff. Try to apply it on your training and see what is going to be like, you know, tuned to your body. And there is something I want to mention here. Some people, they think like, you know, hydration means like we overload, taking like, you know, stuff that can hydrate us. So they can mix or combine between gels and kind of iron drinks. This is too rich for your system. Try to avoid that and just to stick to one thing. And as I said, experience that thing during the practice. Then you can go to your race event and apply it.
Yusuf with us this afternoon. And many of you getting in touch with questions and comments around running, please do reach out. As I said, he's the head coach of the ADNOC Abu Dhabi Marathon Training Programme, and you can reach us on 4001. You can use the ARN Play app as well. Or you can do like Roger did, give us a call, 0487155500.
Hello there. Right, I've got two questions. My first would be about the boredom. You'll be out running for a long time. How do you tackle the boredom when that sets in? And my second question would be, what are your coping strategies for when your body and your brain is telling you, we've had enough now, you can stop, it's fine, don't worry about it? When you're getting those mental and physical messages, how do you push through them?
Two great questions from Roger. I think a lot of people think exactly that, you know, a two-hour run will just be incredibly boring. Do you listen to things when you're running, Yusuf? What do you recommend?
Like listen to things, like listen to your body and your brain, right?
No, I'm thinking about the Afternoons with Helen Farmer podcast. So podcasts or music, or, you know, or are you doing exactly that? Just looking at, you know, being mindful about where you are and listening to your body.
You should listen to your body, and your body is sending you wrong messages, by the way, in the marathon specifically. I'm not saying about the other distances. So what? While you hit the wall, and this is like on the specifically on the last 6 miles or 10K, then you have to just apply a good plan ahead before. So here is my answer to that question. When you start actually from the beginning of the marathon start, you have to sustain easy pace. This is going to help you to drive you all the way to the finish. So when the message that you're going to listen to and telling you to stop and you're hitting the wall, you cannot keep going because of the depleting of the, you know, energy system that you have, then you have to just apply, no, I've been doing this so great and I started like very wisely and reasonably and I can keep going. So this is my pace. I'm going to stick to it to the finish line and this is my rewarding. So you want to hear a voice of rewarding. I want to reward myself today and I want to finish this thing, which is the marathon.
And I think for a lot of people, you know, there's a certain training program you can apply and that's what you're doing on the physical side. But that mental battle, You know, when you're feeling yes. so depleted, that's what often defeats a lot of people. It might not be an injury. It can just be, I've had enough, I want to go home. Has that ever happened to you, even on a race day?
For myself?
Yeah.
Yeah, it happened. And I had to keep it. It's like a mental battle, actually. So I have to finish this thing. I have to sustain my pace that I've been doing, like I'm sustaining it too well. And let's finish it. And then I can go home with like a big satisfaction.
I thought you were going to say yeah. a big sausage pizza.
yeah, exactly. I have to reward myself. Why I'm doing all this and then I'm not getting my results. So that's the thing. I mean, I have to think that I'm going to take home something I want to be proud of. I should be proud. Okay, I did this effort. I started it. And it's the middle, and I have just like, you know, a few things, like a few way to go.
Home or away.
On Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
Welcome back to your running clinic. Coach Yusuf joining us from ADNOC Abu Dhabi Marathon Training Programme. I want to talk diet off the back of a message we've got from Pete Yusuf. Pete's saying, I run before work and I'm never hungry that early, but then I don't have energy. What to eat in the morning before a training run? Thank you. Great question. As you said earlier, a lot of people hitting the pavements and the gym before work and might not be up for breakfast at 5 or 6 in the morning. What do you tend to eat before an early morning run?
Yeah, here is my answer to that. Many people like myself, including myself, when I wake up in the morning, I don't feel like, you know, I want to eat anything, all right? But when I'm expecting a physical workout, it's a must. So body always like, you know, rely on fat and carbohydrates to get us like, you know, the energy to perform in our workout. So we have to eat like something like, you know, really healthy and well balanced before we go to our exercise. And also, like, you know, if we're expecting a race coming that day, we should get up early, and a couple hours before that event we should like, you know, get our breakfast, because usually the races happen in the morning. And to just like, you know, let our stomach, you know, digest that on the right time, and we go to the race without any discomfort. It doesn't have to be a heavy meal, but it has to be like, you know, a good meal with nice or like healthy carbohydrates and fats that we need to help us replenish our energy system for the challenge we have, especially if we have a marathon.
So can you give us some of your normal breakfast go-tos before a race? What have you been known to eat?
Well, myself, I like to. Everyone have like, you know, individual preference for the meal on the breakfast. Myself, I like a toast with a peanut butter and coffee to get my caffeine intake too, and orange juice. This is if I'm heading for a race. But like, you know, other days when I'm just like expecting a normal day, I just go for a good meal than that and eat more. So I can include there like some eggs, some sort of like virgin olive oil, which like really like, you know, are good source of fat. So this is all about it. But for the race, yeah, just should be like a nice toast with a peanut butter and some a cup of coffee and a cup of orange juice, and I'm good to go. That's myself. So other people might, you know, feel like, you know, to get less than that or maybe a little more than that. But I always like, you know, like to stick to a healthy breakfast, not like a heavy one, and try to go do a race. This is going to discomfort you and not get you in good shape for your run.
Is there any truth to the carb loading before? When my dad used to do half marathons, There's a run where we're from called the Great North Run. And the night before, they used to take over this massive arena and have the biggest pasta party. Is this recommended to carb up the night before?
For the night before, because we're going to have like several hours to just like, you know, digest that. I would say, you know, it's fine, but always stick to a good one, like a good carbs. Like pasta, it's a good one. So I go heavy, like, let's say like we're going to have a meal of like a lasagna. That's a good carb there, and we can like eat as much as we need to, but not mixed with the beef, like, you know, a sort of like meat that we can avoid, but we can still, like, you know, eat and enjoy the lasagna. So this is like just like a example for a meal that we can have. But yeah, we can load ourselves like a night before, but make sure that loading is not going to be like, you know, hard to, for the stomach to digest that night.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Hope that helps out there, Pete. We are talking running this afternoon, Coach Yusuf with us. From diet to gear, Safa's been in touch saying, help her to choose some running shoes. So she's got four pairs and they all hurt, even sprayed my ankle running in one of them. You mentioned gait analysis. For anyone who's never heard that phrase before, Yusuf, can you explain what it is and how available it is to, you know, your average novice runner rather than you as a, you know, a championship runner?
Well, I mean, for this topic, I would say, like, you know, you should, like, you know, go and experience what you can, what is tuned to your pronation. And some stores, like, they can offer a nice analysis for the shoes. Try it before, like, you get any, like, a different type. It doesn't mean, like, you have a different type, but you have the right shoe.
Mm-hmm.
But if you can just, like, do your analysis with the shop that you have this equipment, that it can make difference, and if you have, like, the comfortable shoes that you can go with. So I will stick to the thing, like, you know, we cannot recommend a specific shoe to you, but we can recommend to go and do the suitable analysis for your foot, to see what kind of shoes you can be comfortable with.
I think that's exactly right. It would be irresponsible for you to say, this is my favourite brand and this is the model, because everyone's foot is different, the width is different. As you say, pronation can be different. I've seen stores, I think there's one in Mall of the Emirates that does gait analysis, and you can try on different brands in the store while on the treadmill, and it will talk about where your heel is striking, your distribution of your weight through your foot. And let's not joke. These shoes are expensive. This is not something you want to be chucking around a few hundred dirhams on willy-nilly. So definitely do that research before.
Home or away.
On Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
But talking running now, Coach Yusuf is joining us live on the line. He is with us from the ADNOC Abu Dhabi Marathon Training Programme, a multiple winner of USA Track and Field Championships for long distance running. So maybe you've never run a day in your life, maybe you run a lot, want to test your limit and try to run a marathon. He's here to answer all of your questions. And Ursula got in touch earlier, Yusuf, saying, I used to run 10K easily until I got COVID. It's really messed up my lungs. And now I'm lucky if I hit 4K jogging and walking. Have you seen this in people you train? Any advice? Will my breathing go back to normal?
Yeah, we experience a lot of, like, you know, kind of situation when the COVID hit, and some people, they used to do even more than 10 and now struggling with that amount of distance, maybe even less. And what I suggest, that don't worry about it, don't feel alarmed. It's just like a temporary situation, and our muscles have a memory that you can bounce back and you can hit the ground again for more mileage. What you have to do is just, like, stick to a structured plan and try to build up your runs again after, like, you know, 2 or 3 weeks. I'm not going to say you're going to completely come back to the shape that you desire to be with, but you can definitely, like, you know, progress again and go back to your shape over the time. And all we know, running is, like, about, like, you know, a good long term of adaptation. And if you consistent to it, you will get to, you know, and to meet your goal.
You said we're going to cast our minds forward to November, and everyone listening who's committed to doing the ADNOC Abu Dhabi Marathon has completed it. Now what? Alan's been in touch on 4001 saying, for recovery, do you recommend ice baths or heat therapy? How do you tend to recover after a long run or race?
Well, this is like a kind of individual preferences. Like, some they are like they can be good with the ice baths. Some people they are like retuned because what kind of, like, you know, body you have. What I can recommend for myself, like, you know, is, and people that like me, I can just, like, go for an ice bath that really, like, helps to build up, like, you know, the damaging cells in the body and can get us, like, you know, in a good shape to train the next day. And some people, they feel like, no, it's like, you know, it's about the heat, and I'm gonna have, like, you know, a hot shower and I would feel, like, you know, fine with it. It's the kind of body nature. But mostly people, like, you know, I've known in my career as elite or amateur, they like to go for an ice bath. And it really helps, like, you know, to build these damaging cells, muscles, to hit the ground from the next day.
I tried an ice bath about a month ago.
And how it goes?
It took my breath away. It was a really interesting evening because it started off talking about breath exercises. So everyone in the group had to hold their breath for as long as they could, and it was timed. And I think I got to like 25 seconds. And then we were taught a breathing technique, and we did it again. And I got to a minute. And then we went outside, we did yoga, and then we did, I think, about 10 rounds of this breathing with incremental gaps of holding breath in between. So the first gap was a minute, the first was a minute and a half. And then we went up and up and up. And by the end, I'd held my breath for 2.5 minutes. And then we used that breathing technique to get into the ice bath. It was really, really interesting. Really interesting. And I've slept incredibly well afterwards. And I was so hungry. I don't know if this is related in any way, but I was ravenous. So really, really interesting. It's talking about how great it is for boosting iron levels, for kind of this breathing as well, for alkalizing the body. It was fascinating. I'm not sure I'd want to do it every week. I think I'd rather have a hot sauna situation and then an ice bath rather than yoga and then an ice bath. But for anyone interested, I would definitely say give it a whirl, because it was an alternative thing to do on a Friday night, I would say. So yeah,
that's amazing.
It was fun. It was a lot of fun.
Yeah.
I think we've got time for one last message. Let's have a look. Okay, Isha. Interesting question. Does running build muscle, or do runners lift weights? Interesting premise. I guess it depends on the type of running. So, I mean, is running in itself enough to keep someone healthy, you know, a good muscle tone, or do you need to build in some other aspects to your training?
I want to say, like, running, it's like really build that muscle definition. Why? Because we use a lot of fat and to replenish our energy system. And when this is happening, it gives us like a good lean muscle mass. I don't want to say a bulk one, but a lean one. Okay, but there is definitely a muscle that they will be built, and the runner would have a good muscle mass over the running fitness if he's like following again like a well planned structure for the training. And yes, running is not about just like, you know, running every day or like just keep running for the whole time. It's also like having a different component for the training in the training schedule, and the gym can be applied. And how often or how many times a week, this is like, you know, up to the timing of, you know, the participants in this program. Mm-hmm. It can, but I advise like with twice a week, if you can go to the gym and hit a dynamic gym workout with a light weight, this is like perfect, like, you know, a perfect plan you can have for your running schedule. Yeah.
Yusuf, so, thank you so much for your advice this afternoon. As you said, your running training program is in the capital as part of the ADNOC Abu Dhabi Marathon training program, which is taking place in November. All the very best to everyone who is involved with you already, and maybe you'll get a few more signups, and all the very best to you come November as well. Yusuf Roshdi there.
Pets and Vets.
On Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
In association with Royal Canin, the trusted expert in nutrition for your cat and dog.
It is essential listening for all of you animal lovers. We are taking your questions on all things animal. So if you've got a little furry friend at home who's feeling a bit under the weather, maybe there's some strange behavioural quirks you've picked up on, maybe some symptoms just aren't adding up and you want a second opinion, this is your chance to speak to the experts. And our expert today is Dr. Rachel Shaw of the British Veterinary Clinic. Dr. Rachel, are you speaking to us from your car?
Hi, Helen. Yes, unfortunately, I am. I'm having a busy day.
I'm between consults,
so we've blocked off a bit of time to have a chat. And this is the safest, quietest place where we won't get too much background noise.
I love it. I do calls from my car too. I'm normally outside when the kids can't see me. So thank you for making time for us today. Really do appreciate your expertise and your time. But yeah, we haven't had you on the show before, so I think I need to do a bit of getting to know you. So can you tell us, do you have any pets currently, Rachel?
Yes, we're a family who love pets. So, and I've been here for a while. So we've rescued many, and currently we have 6 pets in our house.
Okay, I need the full rundown. What are they, and what are they called? Please, let them be good names.
Okay, well, we'll go from oldest to youngest pet, or maybe most recent additions. So we have Max. He's a Saluki Cross Labrador. He is 14. Oh. He was my first addition here in Abu Dhabi. We have Lexi. She's a Saluki mix again. She's 9. Then we have Felix.
Lots of X names. Is this a theme?
Lots of my pets were named before I got them, Helen, because they're rescues. So I don't change the name. If they've got that name, that's how they come. So we've got Felix. He is, oh gosh, he must be 10 now. He's a 10-year-old cat with special needs. He has 3 legs and doesn't walk very well. And then we have Lucy, who is, unfortunately, she has no eyeballs. She's blind due to lots of issues she had. And then we have the small pets. We need small pets in our lives. You know, life is not complete without a small furry pet. So my daughter has a little Flash. He's a golden Syrian hamster. And my son, Aiden, has the latest addition, which is Milkshake, who was a rescue hamster, believe it or not. So we've had her for about 3 months. She's settling in well.
Oh, I love it. Full menagerie. So it sounds like you might have been bringing your work home a bit, Dr. Rachel, over the last few years.
Well, after 15 years, I think we've been quite restrained, really. We could have had a lot more.
I've heard that you knew even at age 5 that you wanted to be a vet. What was it that really thought you were going to work with animals?
Yeah, I mean, I can't say why. I think it's more of a calling, and I think that sounds a little bit cliche, but it was always what I wanted to do. I come from Yorkshire in the north of England, and surrounded by farmland and lots of animals, and there was lots of opportunity to interact with animals, and I just knew I wanted to do that. I always wanted to work with animals, and from the age of 5, when I declared I want to be a vet, I set my goal and was fortunate enough to achieve it.
Oh, well, speaking of someone whose 6-year-old has been saying since she was age 3 that she wants to be a dog trainer and a horse vet, I might be sending her your way for a little internship. Keep her out of mischief. So, Rachel, it is wonderful to have you with us. And as you said, no home is complete without some small, furry animals. You've got some facts about them. Now, we had a couple of hamsters. We had one called Lucy who ate an entire curtain. The whole thing was just shredded and put into a nest. She was a lovely little thing. And then we had a hamster that wasn't as nice as Lucy, unfortunately. But can you tell us some perhaps unusual facts? Can we start with an animal that I didn't know can dance? What's this about?
Yes. So I guess this might be a little bit of a play with their abilities, but essentially guinea pigs can break dance, Helen.
Immediately going onto YouTube to see evidence of this, I'm not going to lie. Why and when? Why would this occur and what happens?
So guinea pigs do have this ability when they're super happy and very content during play. They'll jump in the air and they can rotate their bodies a full 90 degrees, and it almost looks like they've either been electrocuted or that they're breakdancing. So it's called popcorning when they do that, almost like a piece of corn in the pan, popping. And that just means they're super happy and they're really having a great day.
Crikey. Okay, so from happy dancing to fighting to the death, Syrian hamsters sound vicious.
Yes, so unfortunately some little small furry animals aren't as tolerant of each other as they perhaps should be. Mm-hmm. So the Syrian hamster, which is the largest species of hamster, cannot be housed with another Syrian hamster, or unfortunately, yes, they will fight to the death. So I've experienced that as a vet with a few people who didn't know that as well, which is sad.
Oh, creaky. Now, a lot of people have rabbits as their first pet. It's a very popular option, despite them perhaps not really liking being held that much and perhaps not liking children that much. You've got an interesting fact about their teeth, though. What about, because we know that, well, they've obviously got quite sharp teeth. I've been bitten by a rabbit a few times. What's the fact, though?
Yes, so I guess this isn't just for rabbits, it's more for rodents in general, but their teeth grow continuously. They don't stop growing, and they grow at quite a rate, up to sort of 1 millimetre a day they can grow. And because of this unique trait of their dental anatomy, if they're not on an appropriate diet and their teeth overgrow, we do unfortunately see rabbits with dental problems.
So when you say appropriate diet, is that to kind of wear the teeth down almost, or how does it work?
Absolutely, Helen. So when your teeth grow continuously, to make sure that you have a good bite and your teeth match up, what we call the occlusal surface, to ensure that stays in check so that you can be evenly in wear, you need to have the right diet to wear your teeth down to the level that they grow. So we need rabbits to be eating lots of hay and fiber. And unfortunately, a lot of our pet rabbits are a little bit spoiled and pampered and perhaps don't stick to that diet.
Which you'll be paying for at the vet surgery when you come in to have maybe a rabbit root canal.
Pets and Vets.
On Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
In association with Royal Canin, the animal before the owner.
Talking your animals this afternoon, Dr. Rachel Shaw is with us from the British Veterinary Clinic. She is on hand to take your questions, your concerns about your animals. A message here from Jency saying, "Hi Helen, hi Dr. Rachel. My cat Lulu got spayed last Saturday and now she's running around. Is that okay? She removes the collar at night and every time she's feeling playful. She's still on meds until Friday and we're going back to the vet on Saturday for a check, but I'm concerned that she's running around and jumping over like a kangaroo." And then the face palm emoji. A bit worried about Lulu. Sounds like she's in good spirits though.
Yes, Helen. I mean, I think Lulu is perhaps doing credit to her surgeon in that she feels so great after her surgery. But obviously with a female spay, we've made an incision into the abdomen and there is a muscle incision. So the reason we want Lulu to rest up a few days is so that she doesn't do any physical activity that will perhaps tear those muscle sutures, because that's one of the most unpleasant things that can happen after a spay. So although she feels great and she's happy, which is a credit to the surgeon, and she's got good analgesia, it is best if you can confine her to areas where she doesn't have such opportunity to jump. And also if she moves around too much post-operatively, her body will protect her incision. The body's very clever. And sometimes it creates a little fluid pouch over the sutures to protect the muscle. And we call that a seroma. So ideally she should rest up and hopefully she's not done anything too deleterious to her incision. And when you check up with your vet on Saturday, they'll give her the all clear, perhaps, to get that collar off.
Brilliant. All right. I really hope that helps. We've just been talking about small pets and you mentioned dancing guinea pigs, popcorning guinea pigs. And Amzie's been in touch saying, "Thank you for this. We're thinking about getting our girls age 5 and 7 two guinea pigs. Do they make good pets for children? Do you keep them inside or outside? And do they bite? Thank you. I've never had a guinea pig. What would your advice be for maybe a first time pet owner with children who are kind of under 8, Dr. Rachel?
I think for children under 8, they need a pet that they can interact with, mm-hmm. that isn't too skittish, that wants to have human contact, because that's what they're after, really. They want that physical contact and that feeling of being connected. So you need a more robust small pet. I think guinea pigs do fit that bill. Rats fit that bill, although they're not very popular here, Helen. They have a bit of a stigma here, I feel. And I see very few rats here, whereas back home in England, I would see a lot of rats as pets for younger children, because they're big, they're quite robust, they can tame, they can do tricks.
Yeah, you can train them, can't you?
Yeah.
All right, Amzie, let us know. Guinea pig or rat, 4001. A question here, and no name on this one. Saying, we're going on a staycation. I was wondering if it's okay to leave our two cats at home for 3 days. Don't feel comfortable letting a cat sitter into our home, and we can't leave them at a pet hotel because I haven't had their jabs yet. In terms of food, we'll leave ample dry food and water as well, although three-day-old water isn't ideal. Is this cruel or will they manage? Thank you. What would your advice be?
I think you have to make your own assessment of that as to the nature of your cats and how well they get on with each other. And whether you feel that they'll survive, you know, emotionally as well without your input for those 3 days. But from a practical point of view, of course, you can leave enough food for 3 days. That's fine. Hopefully they won't eat it all on day one. And you'll come home to big piles of that lovely undigested cat vomit that they love to do.
Welcome home.
I would probably also ensure, if you are going to leave them for 3 days, that you have extra litter boxes, because cats can sometimes be quite fastidious like we are. And if the lavatory is not clean, they're looking for a spare toilet. And if there's no spare toilet, then we do get some litter box untraining with some unpleasant results. You might come back through and be greeted by less than an optimal gift on your return. Mm-hmm. So I think although it's doable, for me, I would still have someone pop in and at least check on them and scoop a litter box and refresh the water and check they had food still. Because for 3 days, they could eat everything. They could party out on day one and then have nothing left for the next 2 days.
Well, that's interesting, isn't it? Because it's not like leaving 3 days worth of food for a Labrador who would wolf it down within minutes.
Yes.
Cats don't seem to have that kind of instinct that dogs do to eat even when they're not hungry. Mentioning there about the 3-day-old water, are there any gadgets, any fountains or anything that could keep water as fresh as possible? What would you, anything on your travels?
Yes, I mean, of course, we also promote cats to drink water because cats are desert dwellers. They don't drink a lot of water anyway. And more recently, we've geared towards recommending pet fountains, as you mentioned, Helen. These are running fresh water through all the time through a filter system. So that would certainly make sure they had fresh water if you had a fountain. But just be warned, as an owner, they're quite labor intensive to clean those filters. Okay. You know, you have to do the maintenance on your water fountain for your cats.
Brilliant. Thank you for that, Dr. Rachel.
Pets and Vets.
On Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
In association with Royal Canin, the trusted expert in nutrition for your cat and dog.
Message saying, don't have any questions, but just a sweet hello from Cozy and Boozy. Aw, hi. Sarah's been in touch with a photo of Bertie, who has his very own Instagram page. He is adorable. In response to a message we had from Farah earlier saying, I spend about 2,000 dirhams a month on my poodle Precious. Food, grooming, visiting pet-friendly places, checkups, toys. My mother thinks it's a bit too much and needs to be reduced by about a half. Curious to know how much other pet owners spend on their pets and what Dr. Rachel thinks. Well, Sarah's been in touch saying, this is Bertie. We rescued him last year. We worked out we spend about 1,100 dirhams a month on him with 3 times a week at daycare, food, toys, etc. So Dr. Rachel Shaw from the British Veterinary Centre, what is your take? We know our furry friends are far from cheap, and that is something that any prospective new pet owner needs to be well aware of. What's your take on spend?
I think it's a very personal choice, Helen. And I think some dogs you can spend more money on than other dogs, depending on the breed. I mean, we mentioned that Precious is a poodle, so there's going to be a grooming requirement. Mm-hmm. And everyone has different ideas about how frequent they would like to have their pet groomed or bathed. I mean, in terms of actual vet visits, you know, if your dog or cat is healthy and you're visiting the vet infrequently, you know, just for annual checkups, then that wouldn't amount to 2,000 dirhams a month. So perhaps with the Precious the poodle, we could economize somewhat if we did some of the non-essential veterinary stuff ourselves. I mean, for example, a good way to bond with your dog is to bath it yourself at home and eliminate the need to take to a grooming parlor or have a mobile groomers come, say, once a month. And that would reduce some costs for Farah.
But equally, it's preference, isn't it? If you've got the money and your pet is your priority, much like the way that people might spend on travel or clothes for their kids or meals out, it's your choice how you spend, Farah. Zero judgment from us. But as you say, there are ways to economise, and I hate the thought of people abandoning animals because of the cost. So please do consider this before you get an animal. We did the teeth cleaning last week, Dr. Rachel.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Bit of an eye-watering cost on that one. 2 dogs under general to have their teeth cleaned. I was like, you're lucky that I love you, because that just cost about 3,000 dirhams. But yes, I love them.
But I would say that you've saved yourself money in the future, Helen, because if you keep your dog's teeth clean, hopefully you're going to avoid the need to have extractions in the future, which would be more costly and more physically, you know, more impacting on your pet. So you're being a responsible pet owner and you're spending your money wisely in advance.
I'm also thinking about their breath. So it's thinking about my own sanity and my own enjoyment of having them in the home. I wanted to come to a message here, and there's no name on this one, Dr. Rachel, but I think it's a really valid one to raise. We're talking there about being aware of the cost of pets. And a friend of mine's going through something similar. She's basically got new dog remorse. She got an animal and is now completely overwhelmed by how much this dog has taken over their life and their home, dictating the mood of everyone in the family. And this message is saying, we're about to adopt a puppy in 10 days. I'm so anxious after reading everything. I'm not sure I can cope. waking up feeling sick. I've heard of the puppy blues, but didn't think they'd kick in this early. Seriously considering contacting the shelter and cancelling. Is it normal to be this nervous? What would you say to anyone who is having what sounds like pretty significant cold feet about a new animal, Dr. Rachel?
I think it's natural to have anxiety about anything new that you do. For example, I had anxiety today coming on the radio. It's my first time.
And you're great.
But it's never as bad as you think it's going to be. You know, you just need to take a deep breath and give it a try. So when it comes to a pet, particularly a puppy, I mean, this person is being honest with themselves. They know it's not going to be a walk in the park. It's going to be a commitment. So I commend that. And basically, give it a go. If you go and you do adopt or get a rescue dog, what you can often do is have a trial period, Helen, where you see if it fits in with your family, if you can commit and fulfill the pet's needs, the dog's needs, whether you can work around this. And then even if it doesn't work out and you've had a trial period, at least that dog's had a break from the kennels for 2 weeks and had a bit of a holiday, even though it didn't work out with you as the adoptive family. So I would say, think it through, give it a go. You don't know until you try.
I think that fostering or short term is a really good way of looking at it, because it's a huge commitment to your time, to your finances, and sometimes it can come down to a personality thing between the people in the home and that individual animal as well. And we've seen, certainly out of the UK, huge booms in prices of puppies as people during pandemic, when they were working from home, decided to get animals, thinking, well, you know, and in some cases, absolutely right. You know, we're in a position to give a dog a happy home, only for that to, well, change when they've got to go back to the office and that puppy remorse kicking in, and unfortunately not all of those animals having a happy ending, perhaps being sent back. So please do consider very, very carefully before you get an animal. But to the anonymous listener who got in touch on that topic, I think, echoing Dr. Rachel's thoughts, I think these are all really normal concerns to have. And it sounds very much like how I felt before I had a baby, because you know your life's going to be turned upside down for a short period of time. And that already makes you a good pet owner, because you're thinking about how things are going to change and how you are going to need to change in response to this little addition to your home. So thank you very, very much for getting in touch on that. I think we can squeeze in one last question. This is from Max, saying, my big boy, a neutered cat, is just a normal cat, but he seems to urinate a lot more than he seems to drink. Maybe I'm not there when he's gulping the water down, or maybe there's more moisture in cat food than I realise. Any thoughts? So are there anything in the home that could be a diuretic for a cat? Or do you think this big boy could be a secret drinker? Or is it time for a trip to the vets?
So any changes in urination habits for a cat do warrant having a check over. So if your cat is urinating more frequently, even if you don't see your cat drinking more, changes in urination often do warrant a trip to the vets, especially if it is accompanied by other signs like weight loss or a change in appetite. Mm-hmm. And what your vet can do quite easily is obtain a urine sample and just check that with a few simple lab tests there and then to make sure that there's nothing wrong with the urine and there's no signs of disease driving a change in the urination habits.
I think also, as we get into the hotter months, we're in the hotter months. I'm just in denial about it. We need to be really, really careful about the hydration of our animals, just making sure if they are going out and about for an early morning or evening walk that they're at a safe temperature and they are suitably hydrated. But as we said earlier, you know, cats aren't really known for gulping down water like dogs are, and most of them getting a lot of their hydration from their wet food as well. So if anyone is having concerns about that, please do have a chat with your vet. Rachel, thank you so much for your time today. It's been an absolute pleasure to have you with us. And would you come back again, or have I scared you off over the last hour?
It would be a pleasure to come back.
Yay!
Helen, it's been lovely to chat with you.
Perfect.
It's just been very comfortable, and I've thank you to everyone for the not too off the wall questions today.
I filtered them out for you as a first time contributor. Yes. To Pets and Vets. I won't be so generous next time. No, I'm joking. Doctor, thank you so much, really, really appreciate it. Dr. Richard Shaw speaking to us there from the clinic, British Veterinary Centre. So thank you again for all of your messages. Don't forget, Pets and Vets is with you every single Wednesday.
This is Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
Join the conversation
on Dubai Eye 103.8.
You can tune in to Afternoons with me, Helen Farmer, live on Dubai Eye 103.8, Sunday to Thursday between 2 and 5. Don't forget to rate and subscribe to this podcast. It helps other people find us, boost us in the ratings, and you'll get it direct to your phone.
You've been listening to a Dubai Eye 103.8 podcast. To enjoy lots more from Dubai Eye in the United Arab Emirates, just go to dubaieye1038.com or find them wherever you normally get your podcasts.